Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. Today, I am talking to a guest whose work has been utterly inspiring to me. I started reading his work several years ago now, and it helped transform the way I view not just the experimental farming work I'm doing, but biology in total from the foundations up. And you don't get an opportunity to talk to people who have had that much of a transformative impact on you in your life. So I'm very grateful to have Eugene McCarthy here today to talk to us. So Eugene, can you give us a bit of an introduction about who you are and your path through biological research?
Yes, well, I guess I would describe myself as someone who has expertise in hybridization, who's studied hybridization as a phenomenon, as opposed to just studying individual hybrid organisms. A hybrid is any organism that's produced by mating between two other kinds of organisms. Say the best known example is the common mule, which is as most people know, a hybrid of a horse and a donkey. But there are many, many other kinds of hybrids. And I don't know how much you want me to go into here, Shane, but early on from reading Darwin, he has a chapter on hybrids in which he uses them as an example of why biological processes are unlikely to be the result of a deity of God guiding the things. He says things are too inconsistent with hybridization for it to be a regular law imposed by God that's guiding things. In other words, he says, sometimes you have hybrids that are fertile, sometimes you have them not fertile. So there's not the data or whatever doesn't reflect that there's some guiding hand that's keeping the species apart.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people were saying at that time, and some people, many people still say that sort of thing, that God is keeping the species apart by making hybrids sterile. But there are many hybrids that are not sterile, and Darwin pointed that out. And that puzzled me, and that was what got me going on hybridization way back when.
Mm.
But I've studied it extensively since then.
And you've gone through an academic career as an evolutionary
right.
biologist?
Yes. Well, I got very interested in hybridization. And back at the time when I was getting interested in all this, I was undergraduate in mathematics, and I got an undergraduate degree in math, but then I got more interested in hybridization, switched over to genetics, and eventually got a master's and then a PhD in genetics, and have pursued this interest for many years now. And so it's interesting to me, or it was surprising to me, that the mule is not a very good example of hybrids in general. You have that case where, yes, most mules, the vast majority of mules, do not produce offspring, but there are many other types of hybrids where they do produce offspring, and they produce them on an ongoing basis, and they occur in a natural setting. People have an idea that there's no hybridization going on in a state of nature. And in fact, in some states here in the United States, they've passed laws against hybridization. And you can't, you're not allowed to hybridize birds in New Jersey, for example. But at the same time, in the woods in New Jersey, there's hybridization going on all the time between birds.
Mm.
So there are a bunch of criminal birds out there that are doing the thing that it's not allowed.
And
because people imagine it's an unnatural thing, and it's not a proper thing for breeders to do, or that sort of thing. There's a kind of a prejudice against it in a lot of people's minds, I guess.
So you've written an extensive set of books documenting all of the known hybrids in the birds, and when you present that information to people, they're like, "Oh, well, maybe birds can do it, but mammals, they hybridize much. It's not a bigger deal for mammals to hybridize." But you've also extended your work into studying mammal hybrids. Can you briefly talk about those studies?
Well, I guess my work is an extension of my early, delving into the question. When I first way back was reading Darwin, he's saying there are various hybrids that could produce offspring. I didn't really believe that first, because that went strongly against my ideas about what hybrids were and their characteristics. But then I went and actually read various reading reports, and at first there were ones that he mentioned himself, and he was correct. There are various hybrids that do produce offspring fairly well, and even the mule, the common mule, there are occasional reports of female mules producing offspring, and then in China they have a breeding program where they artificially inseminate mules, and they take semen from either horses or donkeys, and they use that to inseminate mules, and they actually can produce offspring doing it that way too.
If I recall correctly, the Romans viewed a mule giving birth as an omen. So
That's right. Yeah,
it must have happened.
it
It
goes back
happened
even
often
earlier than
enough.
that. It goes back to Greek and Babylonian times. It was considered, well, I guess, a portent. It could be a good thing or a bad thing. Like, I remember there's one case, I think it's Herodotus, talks about where a mule was born during the siege of Babylon, and this Persian soldier who owned this mule took it as a portent that Babylon was going to be conquered, and he took it upon himself, and he used a strategy that allowed them to get into the city. But it was all based on he was inspired by his mule to do this, and that led to the conquest of Babylon. But yes, it's there are many things that are considered portents, but that's one of them that were considered to be portentous.
So yeah, the main thing I wanted to establish, you've been like professionally studying particularly animal hybridization for your whole life, and
Yes, it's been like since I got first interested in it back in the 1980s, and have been looking into it, writing about it ever since then. So, yes, it's been a long time.
So let's lay a foundation and get a sense of the history of theories about how organisms become the forms that they are, and once we get beyond a static view of the world, how they change. So do you want to talk a bit about like creationism and Darwinism,
I'll
and
try to
then
outline it. I mean, basically, the world's divided between at present between creationism and Darwinism. There's the view under creationism that the various types of organisms were created at the get-go, way back when, and they haven't changed since. And then the Darwinian idea, of course, is that under the influence of natural selection, they change over time and become new types of organisms. And eventually, by that sort of process, we have all the organisms that we have today, but starting out with, simpler types early on. And then the ones that did better and produced more offspring came to the fore and spread and are now dominant.
And the early views of Darwinism were that it was a very gradual process of random
Yes,
mutations and then selection.
and so the thing that strikes me about the two viewpoints, Shane, is that there are some aspects of both of them that are valid. If you look at the fossil record, you see that there are sudden appearances of new types of organisms that go on unchanged for many millions of years. For example, the brachiopod lingula, looks kind of like a clam with a long tongue coming out the back. That organism has been unchanged for the last 500 million years, and it just appeared suddenly back in the Cambrian, and it has not changed since. I mean, that's an extreme example, but there's this aspect of the fossil record that gradual selection, as described by Darwin, doesn't account for very well, and that's the fact that if you look at any particular type of fossil organism, the early specimens, like lingula, for example, pretty much exactly like they do in the late specimens. The one lingula which still exists looks like it did in the Cambrian. Or if you look at a ginkgo tree, it looks like it did 200 million years ago if you look at the leaves, and as it does now. And so where is the gradual selection that's going on? And then they also appear suddenly. And so it's that sudden appearance aspect and the unchanging aspect there, that's, kind of agrees with creationism. But at the same time, the fact that different types of organisms appear as you go on in time through the fossil record agrees with Darwinism. And so there are ways in which both ways of looking at the world kind of agree with things, but neither one takes into account, seems to take into account all of the data. And so what you really need is something that will produce things suddenly and then leave them pretty much unchanged thereafter, but that will also do that on an ongoing basis. In other words, you can have organisms appearing 500 million years ago, you can have them appearing 400 million years ago, 100 million years ago, or 10,000 years ago, whatever. All along the way, you can have new types of organisms appearing, which is what you see in the fossil record, as opposed to creationism, which, you know, says that everything appeared, you know, like what, 3,000-4,000 years ago, all at once. It hasn't changed since. So that's, you know, completely inconsistent with the fossil record. But the small thing that is consistent is that it doesn't appear that the typical organism in the fossil record changes significantly over time. It just stays the same. Like years ago, I was at a conference in California, and I talked to Stephen Gould about punctuated equilibrium. And I said to him at the time that I didn't think that most geneticists would ever accept punctuated equilibrium because it didn't specify any sort of process, any sort of biological process by which the thing that he was describing could occur. And he said, well, that doesn't make any difference. It's just a fact that that's what's in the fossil record. And they have to accept it because it's a fact. It's observed data, and they have to accept it, whether it's explained or not. And so at that point, that was when I started going into trying to come up with theoretical explanations of how it might occur. And since I've been studying hybridization already for years at that time, I started thinking in terms of that, how it would produce the observed pattern of punctuated equilibrium, where you have new organisms appearing suddenly and then staying the same over time.
Oh, no, sorry, I'm interrupting before we go on too much further. Is it worth pointing out that hybridization and Darwinian-type steady accumulation of mutations aren't necessarily incompatible with each other? They're probably both occurring with different dynamics?
Yeah, they can, but I'm just saying that the Darwinian viewpoint is not sufficient in itself to account for the sudden appearance, say, of lingula. You have no lingula, then suddenly lingula in the fossil record, and then unchanged thereafter. Where, you know, if there is this gradual selection of small differences over time, you would see a fairly continuous departure in morphology, in form over time in the fossil record. You'd have something that was sort of like lingula, a little bit more like lingula later, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. Then lingula would appear. And then presumably lingula would go on changing thereafter after it appeared and keep being selected. But that's not the sort of pattern you see. You see no lingula, then at a certain point in a certain stratum in the fossil record, it appears. And then after that, it doesn't change. Same thing with ginkgo, like below a certain level, it's not there. You get up to a certain level in the strata, and then it's there, and it continues on to the present day. And then there are all these organisms in the past that appeared for a while and didn't change after they appeared, and then they went extinct. Say, Tyrannosaurus rex is a famous one. It's no longer around, but it was all at least the same when they're looking at it in the fossil record, early on or late, it was the same. And so what you need is some sort of biological mechanism that allows for that. Sometimes they try to kind of force the data into the Darwinian shoe. They just say, well, there was, for whatever reason, a lot of mutation concentrated into this certain period of time, and the organism appeared, and then after that, not much mutation was going on, and so there wasn't any change thereafter. And so selection could act during that period when there was a lot of mutation going on, and then things stabilized thereafter. But that doesn't, it's kind of almost like talking like about ghosts to my mind, because there's no explanation of why there would be a lot of mutation at a particular time and not thereafter. Whereas if you talk about hybridization, you can imagine almost any type of organism being produced suddenly by that means. And then generally speaking, with hybrids, you have a variable population at first for a few generations, but then it rapidly stabilizes to a particular form, and then this goes on stably thereafter. So, I mean, there's a lot more to it than that, but hybridization provides a mechanism that does account for the weighted equilibrium pattern that Gould and Eldridge originally proposed back in the 1980s.
So possibly one reason why there's reluctance to embrace this hybridization mechanism is because it casts an even harsher light on the species concept. So do you want to tell me a bit more about your perspective on that? This very, even before you get to hybridization, there's all these problems with the species concept and arguments over what it actually means. So, and I know you have an amazing website. I'll put the links in for that. Macroevolution.net. Yep. And you have a really wonderful account of the history of this, but could you give us a taste of where our concept of species originally comes from and where the weak points are in its conception?
Well, originally species, I mean, way back when, like in Roman times, it just meant an appearance or just the way something looked. And then...
Do we still use that to refer to coins as being different species of currencies?
Well...
I think I've seen that somewhere.
That may be the case, but I can't really say. Species is, in that sense, is different types of coins or currency, isn't it? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm sure I've heard it used that way.
But anyway, the point is that during the early scientific era, it was taken over for use as a term to describe different forms, different types of organisms. And as time went on, it was believed kind of in a religious context, I guess you'd say, because people at that time were more religious than most people are now. They thought of God as guiding everything, and they were saying that we couldn't have organisms interbreeding with each other, otherwise things would become destabilized and you'd have all sorts of weird new forms appearing. And so there was this idea that God was keeping these various forms apart. And so it became almost sacrilegious to describe or to accept the possibility that different types of organisms could breed and that they could produce offspring together, because that would violate popular notions of a divine order imposed upon the earth by God. And so it was offensive for that reason. It was offensive because it also involves sex. And, you know, sex, of course, is taboo. And so these taboo notions were about hybridization were pre-Darwinian. And I think that Darwin was kind of savvy politically, or really quite savvy politically, because he just stepped around that whole topic for the most part and just focused on proposing a sex-free method of producing new types of organisms where you didn't have to have any hybridization that was going on, which a lot of people still are disturbed and offended by hybridization. And I think that's a hangover from the early religious viewpoints that I was talking about a minute ago. And it's also considered pagan, heathenistic. It's not considered a thing that nice animals do, I guess you'd say.
So this all led to species being more carefully defined through the biological species concept. So some of my listeners may not have heard what that is before.
That was like the biological species concept, at least to my mind, is just a way of accommodating this incorrect view of hybridization that is widely held in people's minds, the idea that the things that the various populations that people call species are supposedly unable to interbreed with other such populations. That was the idea that is widespread. And then in conceptualizing evolutionary theory in those terms, it avoided contradicting widely held beliefs. And people were ready to accept right away that you didn't have that sort of thing going on. And then once you could say, well, this population is isolated from other populations and it's not getting any input from other populations, you can say that, well, it must be then it's a matter of selecting among the ones, the various individuals within that population as to which ones are better, which ones are able to produce more offspring. And it just boils down to selection within that population. Whereas if you have input from other populations, all those population genetics models don't work. It's only if you can say that the population is isolated from other populations that you can build all these models that they build in population genetics and have them work out mathematically. Because as soon as you start having input from other populations, it all gets very messy and the assumptions no longer hold. So the biological species concept, the idea that a species is a population of organisms that can interbreed with each other, but not with other such populations, allows for setting up a basic axiom for these mathematical models that are used in population genetics. And if you don't have that axiom, then you can just get rid of perhaps not all, but most of those models. They just become invalid because you no longer have your basic assumption anymore that it's a population that's not getting any input from elsewhere.
Would you entertain the notion that all sex is hybridization? Like you're mixing the genes of two individuals in the most ordinary kind of sex. So you're trying different combinations of genes from the population of cells in those two organisms. So it's not that much. It's like a next level up to take two populations that usually interbreed among themselves, but then occasionally swap DNA genetic material between those populations. So your thoughts on that?
Well, I guess I would say that the whole idea of levels and distance when you're talking about organisms is fraught. It's not easy to define species. It's not easy to define a genus. It's not easy to define a family. It's like those are all things that are defined more by tradition or convention than by any sort of objective criteria. And so people might consider small differences and large differences, but what is small and what is large? It's very difficult to define. I mean, is say a human interbreeding with an ape, is that small compared to a human interbreeding with a snail? Yes, it's hard to quantify. It's hard to say exactly what you're meaning, and it's hard to draw inferences for that reason. But I would say that if you're just wanting to know my opinions, that these things are more, these notions of distance are things that are perceived more by the human mind than something that has actually existed in nature. In other words, you have a system of classification that's set up by humans, and they take the various organisms on Earth and put them into that classification system. But as to whether a gamete from an organism in classification A is going to successfully interact with a gamete from an organism in classification B, that's an open question. It's not something that is automatically enforced by setting up a system of phylogeny or a tree of life. It's that those are human constructs, and what those gametes choose to do with each other is at least not clearly implied by the things that humans have set up. it may be that you can experiment with those gametes and see whether they can unite to form a hybrid, but it's not something that's automatically implied by anything that humans do or any rule that humans know about. It could be.
And as examples, like as extreme examples, you could take two selected individuals inside what's very much the same species and have just one key genetic incompatibility that means that they can't produce viable offspring. That happens in like
Yeah, there
pairs
are
of
lots
humans
of examples.
occasionally. And at the other extreme, you can have a species, I think there's some fish that were separated by tens of millions of years that have no trouble forming fertile hybrids. So yeah, I definitely take your point that there's no clear rule, and that this idea of genetic distance is really just a metaphor that humans use to like shuffle species names around on a piece of paper.
Yeah, so and I'd add to that most taxonomists don't really know very much about hybridization. They, for the most part, have never read a single report about a single breeding, nothing from any breeder in their lifetime. They've just been putting various types of organisms into tree structures, phylogenies, and they have no notion about what actually might have been reported about hybridization. And so there's a disconnect between those two activities, at least in my experience. There's people have the idea that biologists know all about everything biological, but they generally speaking have very narrow interests. I mean, my interests are narrow in many ways. I'm narrowly interested in hybridization. Although I'm also interested in the implications of hybridization, but most people that are constructing phylogenetic trees, say, are concerned with enumerating characteristics and translating those characteristics into affinity or distance in a tree. And they don't do too much else. That's what, that keeps them busy just in itself. And so they don't try to see whether various branches of their tree are connected by, say, hybridization.
For the general audience, it's probably worth when we talk about phylogeny, there's kind of a few different versions of it. The 19th century was based mostly on anatomy. And the biologists divided all of the species up into different levels of groupings that you'd have species, genus, family, order, kingdom, like and all sorts of subdivisions in between. And almost all of that work is being swept away by the new use of phylogenetics, where you pull DNA sequences out of the organisms and then run it through supercomputers to fit it into these branching models that assume that it's a Darwinian kind of accumulation of my mutations and then populations becoming isolated from each other over long periods of time. And do you have any thoughts about that history and where hybridization could change the way we view all of that information?
Well, Shane, it's like these various phylogenies, trees of life, or however you want to describe systems of classification, it's almost like they're the latest in Paris fashion or whatever. They just keep changing over the years. The idea is that by a lot of study, you'll eventually capture the true history of life in the form of a tree. Of the true pattern of descent, but
That's that famous little cartoon that Darwin scribbled in his notes of a little branching tree.
that was like supposedly his big insight was that classification reflects history, a history of descent. But just because you have a classification doesn't mean that you've shown there is a history of descent that's bifurcating, that's branching, forking like a tree over time. It doesn't show just because you've got a classification that's set up in that way that such a history did exist. I mean, the example that I've used repeatedly is, the various things in my basement, like the washer and dryer and the refrigerator there and the table and all the different objects that are in there can be arranged on the basis of similarity into a similar sort of bifurcating tree, but it doesn't mean that my refrigerator is descended from my laundry, my washing machine. It doesn't mean anything. It just means that they've been arranged into that arrangement. And you have to separately show that they somehow share a common ancestor, which I would say is unlikely. That my refrigerator is not sharing a common ancestor with my washing machine. It's just because I arrange them into that sort of classification system. It doesn't imply it. And so you have to somehow get that from genetics or the fossil record. But if you look at genetics, fossil record, and organisms that are existing, there's lots of hybridization going on. So hybridization, if it is widespread, would imply that you're going to have various different ancestors. It's not going to be everything going back to a single common ancestor, but they...
You used a really lovely analogy with me of turning the tree of life upside down. Did you want to explain that again? I just found it so surprising. Yeah, what's that idea?
Well, I mean, if the idea with the Darwinian outlook is that you have, say, common ancestor A, and then the population split up, that ancestral population splits up and mutates and diverges over time till you have descendant populations B and C. But with hybridization, you have present time organism A, and then you have ancestral organisms B and C, and then B and C each have their two or more ancestors. Say C has G and F as its ancestors, and B has D and E as its ancestors, or sometimes, you know, more, like, you know, you have three different organisms. For example, with modern bread wheat, it's derived from three different types of organisms. And so as you're going back in time, if you went to any one of those three organisms that wheat is descended from, each of those probably, if there's lots of hybridization going on, would have multiple organisms. And so as ancestors, so as you go back in time, you have more and more ancestors instead of it narrowing down as you do with the Darwinian viewpoint. So that's what I was saying when it flips the tree upside down, just by looking at it this other way. There's a lot of things like that that change when you're thinking in terms of hybridization. But,
do you interact much with the phylogenetics, like the mainstream phylogenetics research community? And do you get a sense that they're
aware? I have in the past.
Aware
I don't
or
really
Are they mostly just kind of routinely applying established techniques to new data sets? Because there's so many organisms out there, you can just run through the sequencer and then cram all the data into the models on the computer.
And as new organisms are analyzed and their characteristics enumerated, they introduce them in to the phylogenies, and sometimes it throws a wrench in the works and they have to retract previous findings and propose new models. I think I mentioned to you, I'm not going to name any names, but there's a very famous person that I was always in the lab down the hall for many years. And I was talking with him once at a conference, and he was telling me that he always limited his students' small data sets and to small numbers of organisms, because if you didn't do that, you got inconsistent results. And you got, you know, in other words, you got distinct phylogenies that messed up your results and made it hard to publish. And to me, that is what you would expect with a lot of hybridization going on, that you would have things looking messy and inconsistent like that. But by building that into the process, that's all swept under the rug.
Do you suspect, I know in botanical phylogenetics, there's often quite large groups of species that are really difficult to connect to the tree. They're kind of unplaced taxa. And I wonder if they might be another hint of like really deep, potentially wide hybridization events that happened somewhere back in the midst of time.
Yeah, well, as long as you have hybrid going on at all different levels, whatever those levels might be, as I say, they're hard to define. But if you have both occurring both between closely related and distantly related organisms, then you will have situations where you have peculiar anomalies, such as what you're saying. I always think of our, oh, what's his name? Williamson. He's the guy that he proposed that the various organisms, not organisms, but insects that undergo a radical metamorphosis where they have a larval or maggot form in their early stages and then develop into an insect with legs and wings later in life. He proposed that those were derived from hybridization between different phyla. In other words, there are phyla that are composed all of worms, and then there are other, say, within arthropods and within insecta, there are insects that do not undergo such a metamorphosis. And he said that those non-metamorphic insects got together with these various worm and larval forms that are existent in other phyla that don't transform into insects, that they got together and hybridized and produced these insects that do have this early larval form, and that was advantageous because the adult form could fly around and move around freely to find food sources for their larva to live in, lay eggs there, and then the larva would do well in that environment.
If I recall correctly, the emergence of those metamorphosing insects was very sudden, and it's a bit of a mystery about how the that new form of
Well, yeah,
insect.
that's the thing. It's like that's how the conventional outlook handles a lot of these things. They said it's a mystery, but that's not good enough as far as an explanation. It's like that's to my mind, it's not good enough. You have to have some specific method by which it can occur. Otherwise, it's just hocus pocus. So.
Do you suspect that applying different mathematical models that allow for hybridization could potentially make better use of the vast amount of genetic information that's being accumulated? Like it could be reanalyzed through a different lens at some point?
Well, yes, you have to look at each different situation. It can be applied to any situation where you have an organism that you think was likely the derivative of hybridization between two other types of organisms or three other types of organisms. You can use, once you have their, say, the genomes in the form of nucleic acid sequences available, you can analyze that. We're not going to get into it until subsequent programs, but I do have a paper I just published where I analyzed human origins in that way. So, well,
I'm
in
very interested to talk to that.
silico analysis, what?
Yeah, I would maybe refer to other recent studies where they used archaic Neanderthal and Denisovan genomes to
Yeah,
look at
definitely,
modern
but.
humans and see that there are some, there's strong evidence of hybridization with those old, relatively isolated populations.
Yeah, well, they can do that, or they can go back to, say, Williamson's metamorphosing insects, and they could look, say, to see whether there are traces of two different phyla there in their genomes. They can do that. But as long as they imagine that that's impossible, they won't do that.
And
And
I
so.
believe it's a lot easier if you have reference genomes of the putative parent species. If you don't have that information, if you've only got a modern population, it's much more difficult to tease apart. I believe with like equivalent to Neanderthal introgression into human genetics today, there's much harder evidence, much more difficult to define evidence of ghost populations in Africa that contributed to modern humans as well. But because we don't have similar quality fossils from those African specimens, it's more speculative.
Well, you always have some cases, Shane, where it's more difficult and others where it's obvious. I don't know. There are lots of cases where it's not even, at least in my mind, necessary to conduct any sort of genetic analysis. Say there are animals that occur here in the United States that have the body of a moose, but they have the horns of an elk. And so those organisms, those are apparently, very obviously, hybrids to me. I mean, like, how is a moose going to develop elk antlers if it's not a hybrid between a moose and an elk? How does that occur exactly? Unless you're going to say something like it's a recurrence of some ancient trait, which is pretty much an unknown process.
Well, I mean, now's probably a good time to start talking about concrete examples of well-established hybrids, because as you said, people who just know biology often assume that hybrids are rare or infertile or insignificant, but once you actually start looking, you find them everywhere. So, do you want to talk about bird hybridization first? Do you have any interesting examples that are worth fleshing out just to make it more concrete?
Well, there are various well-known examples, like the domestic fowl, chicken, is considered to be a hybrid of the what yellow jungle fowl and red jungle fowl, where there's a hybrid zone for that, where there's ongoing hybridization in the middle of India. And then there are inputs from, I believe, also the gray jungle fowl, but that's pretty much just accepted now that that's the case. And there's, say, the red factor canary, which is derived from hybridization between South American siskin and the regular canary. So it's like a bird that looks red instead of yellow, like an ordinary canary. There are other types of hybrids that are produced on an ongoing basis for human consumption. Like there's a very popular hybrid for that purpose is a hybrid between a mallard and a Muscovy duck. And that is produced like hundreds of thousands. But in that case, the hybrid is not very fertile. But in the previous two cases, of course, like roosters are extremely fertile. So it depends on that's one thing that's difficult about hybridization is that each different case is different. Some are more fertile, some are less fertile, some are easier to produce, some are more difficult to produce. And it's sometimes just happens by chance, and other times you can, with persistence, produce the type of organism that you're aiming at. It just depends on the situation. I mean, probably people did not intend to produce red wheat, but they found that this allopolyploid that just appeared in their field was easy to maintain, had lots of good characteristics, and they propagated it. There have been many types of organisms that appeared in that way. I believe the navel oranges just appeared on a branch of a tree years
Citrus is a
ago.
really good example of this because the genetics of the modern forms has always been a mess, but through a whole lot of work, they've traced it back to, I think it's three main wild species that have hybridized, and then those hybrids have hybridized with others. And it's this kind of tangled knot of relationships that have spat out different recognizable forms over time.
Like also like brassica, cabbages, broccoli, etc. They're all like extremely hybridized. Brussels sprouts. They're just all these different forms that can be produced by hybridization within that group. And then it can also be that you can bring in traits from more distant groups. It might be a little bit more difficult, but as I was saying, it's hard to define exactly what's meant by distance, and it's not always predictable what the level of difficulty will be in such situations. So it could be that you could bring in something from outside brassica into brassica that some trait that you wanted to have for them by hybridization. And it could be done very rapidly.
A really almost too good to be true account that I read recently was with the Galapagos finches that were so key to Darwin, that a bird from one of those islands got blown by a storm and arrived at another island. And the ecologists actually observed it pairing up with a different species. And then its offspring formed a hybrid swarm that quickly stabilized into a new kind of Galapagos finch, and that happened within like I think under a decade.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. It happens so rapidly that in the fossil record, it doesn't even show. I mean, it would not show. I mean, say if you went a million years from now, you went to that island and looked at the strata, you would just up to a certain point, that bird would not be there, and then after that point, it would be there. And so that's what I'm saying about it, fitting with punctuated equilibrium, that observation of the false circuit, it fits with that. Whereas it would be hard to explain in terms of the Darwinian model how that bird appeared so suddenly. Although, in all the cases where they have not had eyes on observation like that case, they assume that that's not what happens. But it seems that all the cases where they actually have determined where various breeds or various types of naturally occurring organisms, where they actually came from, it turns out that there's been hybridization involved.
A lot of invasive species have hybrid origins too, don't they?
Well, in that case, I would say what usually happens is some organism comes in from outside. In other words, it comes in and starts hybridizing with one that's already there. And then because it's producing lots of hybrids, it tends to wipe out the one that is there because it's more aggressive and or more prolific or for whatever reason it causes a threat in that way. But as far as a new species being invasive, a new hybrid being invasive in itself, are you thinking of a specific example of that?
Isn't there something going on with mallard species conservation?
Well, yeah, in that case, it's like what I was saying. It's not that a hybrid between a mallard and something else went into a new area. It's like the mallard went in. And then, like in New Zealand, a mallard was introduced back in the 1800s and started hybridizing with the Pacific black duck. And now there's scarcely a purebred duck left there. They're all like tainted or affected by hybridization. I don't want to say tainted because it's a negative word, but they're strongly...
And species has this air of purity to it as well. Like conservation is often motivated by this idea of some perfect, pristine, walled off set of genes in that population that must never be changed.
Yeah, it's a quasi-religious sort of feeling that it has, the word species. In fact, if you look at it as a biological process, it's a stable form. It's a stable reproductive cycle. It's a thing that reproduces itself, much like a function that in math, that you put an input in and the input of that function gives an output that's identical to the input, that's stable. That's something that will, if you do it over and over again, it's going to stay the same. And it's the same with the things that are called species. There are things that it's not true for all things that are called species, but most of the things that are called species can reproduce themselves. And of course, there are other things that are called species just because they're recognized as being distinct from other forms. So for example, there are all these different types of hybrid birds that have been seen once, twice, or maybe 10 times, and they've been described as species just because they're different from anything that anybody had seen before. They say, oh, I've found a new species. And so, but all they're really saying is that it's a new form that's different from any pre-existing form. And then there are other ones that just are being produced on an ongoing basis, and they don't recognize them.
That's really reminiscent to often early naturalism described the males and females of particularly birds as different species until they realized they were genetically connected to each other by just ordinary sexual reproduction. But if that's like a form of extremely close hybridization, then the mixing of genes between more separated populations occasionally to produce distinct forms, it's kind of the same pattern, just on a different scale.
There's the scale, which is a subjective thing, and then there's also the history of the way things thought of. It changes. Like something will be thought of as a species at some point in time, but later as a hybrid. Like, for example, Brewster's warbler here in the United States back in the 1800s was described as a species. But as time went on, people started saying, well, it has these very characteristics of the blue-winged and the gold-winged warblers, so it must be closely related to them. And then eventually they started saying, well, this is actually one of the common hybrids that are derived from hybridization between those two birds. And then they stopped calling it a species. But until things are worked out in that way, so that they know the actual origin of any given type of organism, there's a very strong tendency to describe it as a species. Even if you've got only one of them that you've ever seen, one specimen, there are all these birds, hundreds, that have been seen just from one specimen that are described as species.
Are the
But
whales and
it's likely
dolphins
that they're just hybrids.
are the whales and dolphins a good mammalian equivalent of that pattern? That there's a lot of sporadic hybrids that turn up between more common or more abundant forms that are frequently misidentified as a new species until their origin is figured out.
Yeah, I think that was the case for the hybrid between the blue whale and the fin whale, that back during whaling times, it had a separate species identification, and then eventually they realized what it was. But it was, I can't remember the name, but I think that that's the case for that. That happens a lot, though. There are many different cases where, if you look at the cross historically, initially, the response is when they see this new type of organism that's, oh, we have a new species here. And then as it's investigated more carefully, it emerges that it's actually of hybrid origin. So that should, I think, inform our viewpoint of what all of these other types of organisms actually are that we have not determined their origin. We should not assume that their origin is something other than what we have commonly found that origin to be. In other words, so we find all these organisms have been of hybrid origin, and we have not identified any organism with any certainty that it's of gradual origin, such as what Darwin describes. We haven't found that to be the case for any organism. As far as I know, there's no definite verification that's occurred for that. And yet, the assumption, the default assumption, is that all these organisms that have not had their origins determined did have a gradual origin. So it's contradictory to what is ordinarily done in science, which is to describe things in terms of what has actually been seen to cause the effect, and instead saying, well, it's something else that we've never seen.
Yeah, just invoking the enormous timescales of the geological past to kind of paper
But
over the problems.
they say, well, we can't see that because that's taken so long and we can't see that. But all the ways that you can look at it, which really that amounts to the fossil record, that's the only way that you can actually look to see whether things gradually change. If you see that the typical fossil organism gradually changes as it goes up through the strata, then that would be consistent with Darwin. But as Gould and Eldridge pointed out like 40 years ago, they weren't the first to point it out. That's not what you see. What you see is a sudden appearance. The typical organism appears abruptly and then remains amazingly unchanged, like very stable over time, over millions of years. I mean, probably a typical length of time exists for, say, 10 million years and then goes extinct without having changed. And so that is inconsistent with the Darwinian gradualistic outlook. And yet that viewpoint, that tempo, that way of evolving is the default assumption for any organism living today that has not had its history determined. That's the default assumption.
There's another thing I wanted to throw in the mix. What are your thoughts on the role of horizontal gene transfer in the evolutionary past?
Well, I think it no doubt happens. And there are various cases where, say, retroviruses have carried across, infectious retroviruses have picked up a gene of one type of organism and carried them across. And that happens by various means, but
It's kind of
I don't think that's a good
it's
reason to
the
sweep hybridization under the rug.
No. It's more, it's like the
Well,
most
I'm not suggesting
extreme.
that you're saying that. I'm not
No,
saying
no,
you're
no.
saying that, but I'm just saying that I think it's what happens a lot when a phylogeny is found to be inconsistent with some other phylogeny. They say, well, this could be accounted for by horizontal transfer, and they don't bring up hybridization because hybridization is it's got this taboo element. It's got something about it that is controversial and unpleasant in a lot of people's minds, even though it's much more powerful than a horizontal transfer could ever be. I think I mentioned to you, I used to work in a lab for years where we studied retroviruses, and they have only a certain capacity for carrying DNA across. Like I was typically, like you could pick up maybe a couple thousand from one organism came across because there's only a certain amount they can fit into the capsule and they're packaging themselves up to move on and be infectious to other organisms. And so one horizontal transfer event, you get like a couple of KB of nucleotides. And
And if you're really lucky,
With
you might get
with
a functional
hybridization, you get
protein.
like millions or billions
Yeah.
of nucleotides in a single hybrid event.
Yeah.
So it's just completely the scale of the potential effect is, vast. But that's not to say that horizontal transfer doesn't happen. Also, though, if you're proposing horizontal transfer, if one is not you, but if one is proposing that as an explanation, it doesn't account for things like the fact that hybrids between just the organisms that are described as distinct species typically can
I
reduce
try
fertility.
I try I visualize horizontal gene transfer as like really, really thin connections that join every living thing on the planet, that they can only transmit a very small amount of information in a very unstructured way, but they potentially allow genetic information to move between any organism on the planet.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's virtually the same thing with hybridization too, though. It's like that's to actually say what the limits are. I mean, I've investigated that quite a lot myself, how distant organisms can be. But I mean, the stuff say that Williamson talks about where you're going between phyla is about as distant as you can get without going between kingdoms. And maybe that there are even like, exchanges between plants and animals at some time back in the past by various hybridizations, but it's uninvestigated. You can't say what's really going on without investigating. And there's, I mean, I could probably count on one hand the number of investigators that have just taken an open mind and tried hodgepodge combinations of organisms to see, what result might ensue.
Do you know where you'd have to look? It would be the protozoans, the protists. Because, like, animals and plants get their own kingdoms, but they're really just multicellular versions of two of the protist families, and there's so many protist groups.
Yeah, well, like, I mean, there are organisms that have animal and plant characteristics, like Euglena has like chlorophyll, is like it's mobile, and since and I believe it has like sensory eye spots.
And I'm pretty sure the phylogenetics of the protist groups is. Like, it's a mess. Like, it's been such a thorny issue to try and cram it into some kind of order. And yeah, I think, I don't know, you regularly see new interpretations come out, but maybe that's a sign of the accessibility of hybridizations that are as wide as plant crossed with animal, but back in their unicellular equivalents.
Well, that's part of my point about this stuff I'm talking about, drawing implications from history. The history in this case is that there's been an evolution in the phylogenies. The phylogenies change over time. And so that's not something you expect. And they're not getting closer and closer to, something. They just every once in a while say move some big groups around, but at every different level. They get changed around. That's not what you expect if they're you if it's something that reflects a real history, you'd expect the broad outlines of the classification or phylogeny to be worked out early on, and then they would just be working out the details of the things that are less easy to distinguish out at the ends of the branches. But in fact, every different level is getting changed around, which is consistent with the idea that there's rampant hybridization going on. So the history of the process of preparing phylogenies, that history itself suggests that hybridization is widespread, because it's either that or like some other process, like you're saying, horizontal transfer, something that would account for the inconsistencies that they find between different phylogenies. You have to have something that would account for that.
Do you suspect that ecological instability increases the rate of hybridization and then that triggers like a new kind of pulse of speciation after some kind of, like a mass extinction event?
Well, I think of hybridization as just something that happens all the time. It's like the legislature in New Jersey, they think the hybridization doesn't and shouldn't happen, but it's happening all the time out in the woods in New Jersey. And so it's just that
I guess it's the
there isn't.
ecosystem that ultimately determines whether those hybrids have the opportunity to reproduce and evolve into something distinct in a persistent population rather than just an individual outlier.
Well, I mean, it could be, Shane, that there's a particular ecological situation or environmental situation that's conducive to a particular kind of hybridization. But when you think in terms of the fact that there are billions of different kinds of organisms on Earth, and then their combinations, because billions of billions of combinations, and then each of those different situations is going to have its specific characteristics that are either conducive or non-conducive to hybridization, then it becomes just a large mass of data points, to my mind. So that, it could be that some are affected by ecology. It could be if some are affected by introduction of new organisms into new environments, or it could be that some are due to like imprinting or various different factors that can result in hybridization occurring. But it doesn't change the fact that hybridization occurs on a widespread basis in a wide variety of organisms. And that it's been occurring like for it's like ever since sex began. I think that that's one reason why sex came to the fore, is because without sex you can't have hybridization, and without hybridization you can't produce all these new types of organisms. And so since sex is heritable, it's a heritable trait, all these organisms that are sexual were successful in producing more types of organisms that were successful. And so the sexuality spread once it originally became available early on, back, around the time of the Cambrian.
Here's an alternative idea. You mentioned before that if you look at the fossil record, recognizable species seem to have a fairly consistent lifespan in the fossil record, with exceptions for like living fossils,
Well, I'd
I
say
mean,
it's really
right?
typical. I mean,
Yeah.
10 million years might be fairly typical, but there's others that are extremely, that are much longer, like, horseshoe crab,
Yeah, they vary a lot.
bintha, like all these different, like they call them living fossils because they existed for so long
But
and
the
still.
idea I wanted to float was that is it possible that hybrid speciation is a way to periodically jump ahead of parasite and disease pressure if an organism like dramatically changes its either ecosystem role or its immune composition, that might give it a kind of refresh in terms of having an advantage
Yeah,
over.
I think there are often like are benefits associated with hybridization. I mean, if you look at the ordinary mule, it has all sorts of characteristics just from the get-go that make it preferable to a horse. But in each case, though, it's like that's the thing, is it's hard to specify anything that is true of any hybrid. I mean, of any different kind of hybrid. Like, it could be that there would be a particular cross where the hybrids would not be susceptible to a parasite that one or both of the parents were subject to, but it's unpredictable. It might be the case that they're even more susceptible in some cases. It just depends on the particular case, I guess I'd say.
Do
But
you know what?
yes, it does have the potential to do that.
It almost feels to me like, you know how you can do a gravitational slingshot, an orbital slingshot around two bodies moving through space, can like get close to each other and then use that to like change their speed and their direction. It's almost like different species in the narrow sense periodically cross over and interact to kind of both get a kind of evolutionary leverage, if that makes sense. I'm kind of grasping for the words here.
Well,
As a counterpoint, often living fossils like ginkgo seem to be monotypic. I think horseshoe crabs kind of fall into this too, don't they? Like there's only really one, maybe I'm wrong with this, but I know with ginkgo, there's only one surviving form and there has been for a long time. And maybe part of its stability is that it doesn't have other related species to readily hybridize with and diversify repeatedly from that point.
Well, I think that is probably the case, and with a lot of long-standing hybrids like that would make sense to me, because I think of hybridization as a disruptor, and the ordinary reproductive cycle as a stable state. So you have hybridization as a disruptor of a stable state. So an organism like the horseshoe crab very reliably has produced offspring like itself for, I think it's 300 million years. They're fossils that look identical to the present day horseshoe crab. They're going back 300 million years. And so if the horseshoe crab did have a hybridization event occur, that would disrupt that cycle. It would produce organisms that were not like the horseshoe crab. It was their stable cycle would have ended in that case for those organisms that were hybrid. And then it would be a matter of whether they could somehow reproduce themselves or produce descendants at least, and whether they could get established as some new form. That in most cases probably doesn't happen. Probably most hybrids, I would say, are just ephemeral and are not able to establish themselves as a new form.
A
But
great example of that is the pitcher plants, the carnivorous plants in your part of the world, in the Americas. There's like eight or so forms, species with distinct traps that are specialized in different kinds of prey items, prey species, the insects that they catch and feed on. And all of those species are very cross-fertile with each other, and they frequently grow in the same habitat. So natural hybrids are very, very common. But they don't seem to reproduce as successfully because their traps aren't optimized for either of the prey types that are available.
And it could be also that they are not ductively stable. In other words, so it could be that
Oh, they backcross to either of
they're
the parent species.
producing they're not producing gametes at the same rate as the parentals are producing gametes.
No, they're fully fertile in this case, but I think there's evidence of them when they do reproduce, they backcross to either of the parent species rather than forming a stable intermediate population.
Yeah, well, it would depend. Like, say, if you took them away to a new spot where the other types were not present, it might be they would get established in that case. But just in general, back to my mathematical background, the as long as the reproductive rate on average exceeds one, in other words, if it is above from one generation to the next, you expect one or more organism to be produced for each organism that existed in the previous generation. In other words, the population goes slightly up from one generation to the next, and it will carry up to a, I mean, go on up to a carrying capacity and then stabilize. But if it's anything below that point, it will go down. And so it's not that you have to have, with hybrids, you don't have to have an extremely well, perfectly selected type. You just have to have one that's good enough to increase. If it increases, then it will go up to carrying capacity. If it's not increasing from one generation to the next, if it's not quite good enough to do that, then it will go down to zero, or it will just depend on constantly being reproduced by hybridization. I think there are a lot of cases where particular type is constantly being produced and is not able to maintain itself. If it were taken, put in isolation, it would die out. But there,
Do you have any
but
thoughts?
it's
Sorry, we've mostly been talking about natural selection. Do you have any thoughts about how this applies to artificial selection and the roles that humans could potentially play in the evolution of life on Earth?
Well, I mean, as far as domestic breeding goes, I think that the usual valuable thing that people get from breeders get from hybridization is the introduction. Well, there are two things. There's intentional introduction of a particular trait by repeatedly attempting to produce hybrids, and eventually they get one that has fertility to allow them to back cross and bring the trait across to a new population. So they introduce that trait into the population. And then there's just the serendipity element that occurs in a lot of cases where people will be, say, crossing a couple of types of animals, and they happen to have something that's interesting that comes out of the cross, and then they happen to be able to get that new type to reproduce itself and become a breed. And so those are the two main avenues. The one that's more controlled is the first one I was talking about, or the introduction, because there you can say finds a particular trait that seems especially valuable and move it into a new, say, crop plant where it would make things go much better. I mean, one thing I talked about, I mentioned in my email, and maybe you would know more about it, but there's this Oaxaca corn that supposedly can fix nitrogen directly from the atmosphere. And so if that's true, I mean, this has been recently reported a lot here in the National Public Radio, and I haven't really checked into it carefully, but just as an example, if that's true that these special rhizomes that it has can absorb nitrogen from the air with the aid of the bacteria that they somehow attract. If those rhizomes could be transferred into other kinds of plants, and you'd automatically have I don't want to use the term self-fertilizing because
What
that's
you mean?
no.
Self-nitrogen
But
fertilizing.
they would automatically get rid of a lot of, fertilizer, chemical fertilizers, just by transferring that trait across. So, I mean, that trait, I think, if it's real, if that information about the Oaxaca corn is accurate, then that is something that it would be worth spending any amount of money and time to transfer that trait into other crop plants, because then you could just get rid of a large proportion of the fertilizer that you're using. But that's just an example.
It's my core idea that it's what I really wanted to get you here to talk about. That idea of rather than taking an established crop and just trying to add a few extra traits from wild relatives, which is done a lot in plant breeding, in commercial plant breeding, to recognize the power of taking two or more wild species, hybridizing them, and then being open-minded about what possible interesting and useful plants could come out of that process, and potentially animals as well, if people are in a position to work with animal breeding.
Yeah, well, as I was saying, like that's the serendipitous approach, which does have large potential, I think, as long as people are open-minded about trying things of that sort. And I think a lot of breeds have come into being in that way in the past, just because farmers kept crops and animals together in a hodgepodge sort of way, so that, they ended up with new things appearing by the crossing going on between the various things they had on their farm. But that's less controlled than the introduction method. It's 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 it has it does have large potential, but it's kind of,
Well,
a roll of
historically,
the dice. It's not predictable or controllable.
yeah, well, a good example historically, macadamia was domesticated quite close to me, and it was just an accidental hybrid of the two of the wild species that a person had grown in their collection side by side. And it's always a bit of a long shot of just deciding I'm going to domesticate this new wild species, but I think the odds are probably a lot higher of a particular attempt leading to something useful. And I mean, in the past, we've relied on those accidents to furnish all the crops and livestock that we rely on. And it's a very narrow range of species that have been domesticated. So yeah, I'm hopeful by having guests like you to talk about that I can encourage more people out there to think about taking on maybe just one wild, wide hybridization domestication project on their farm or in their garden. Because I think there's so much potential out there, and we've only just started to realize how powerful hybridization can be.
Well, much of the reason why I've written about this stuff is to broaden the public awareness of the feasibility and the commonness of hybridization. I repeatedly run into, like I say, I'll go and get my hair cut and I'll be talking with the woman that's cutting my hair, and she'll say, "Well, that doesn't happen, does it? Hybridization doesn't really happen." And I think, well, actually, I've written, like, just my book on bird hybrids. There are 4,000 different kinds of bird hybrids that are happening all over the world. And she thought, "Well, I didn't think the birds ever did that." And so it's like, it's not a widespread notion in most people's minds. And so if I can spread this idea, there is the potential, if more people are trying to do these things on farms all over the place, various new beneficial forms will appear, like here and there on the forms, just serendipitously. And so that's what can be done to encourage that sort of process to occur. But I do think that someone that is making an intentional effort to do hybridization to produce new types of organisms needs to look for traits that need to be introduced, and traits that would be highly beneficial if they were introduced across a broader gap than would ordinarily be expected to be feasible, because there are many hybrids that are between parents that are distant, more distant than what people would imagine to be feasible, that they do occur. And so I think that, you know, like going back to the Oaxaca corn, you could try to introduce it just by putting the pollen from that corn onto various different plants, almost at random, crop plants, and see whether any of them develop that characteristic, and then try to establish them once they did. And of course, there are different ways of establishing plants and animals than just by developing a stable reproductive cycle, a sexual cycle. There are lots of plants and also many animals that are produced asexually. And so that's another thing that we haven't even gotten into, that there's this idea that hybrids can't get established because they cannot reproduce. They're sterile, so they can't produce offspring sexually. But there are many hybrids that are completely sterile that still produce offspring because they can reproduce vegetatively or asexually. I mean,
I believe the choyas, those upright prickly pear kind of cacti in the United States, are a good example of that.
Right. That's definitely the case. There are many. I mean, it's extremely common in plants to be able to reproduce vegetatively by various means. And also, invertebrates are the vast majority of animals, and the great majority of invertebrates can reproduce asexually. And so all of the different crosses that produce an invertebrate, it's likely to automatically establish a new form of life that's stable because it can reproduce itself asexually. So it's not, there are different ways of getting established besides just recovering fertility. And these things end up being described as species, even though they don't even have sexual activities. Like, it doesn't fit, obviously, with a normal definition of, you know, the biological species concept of interbreeding with others like yourself, but not with others that are not like yourself. You aren't interbreeding at all. You're not breeding. Like an asexual clam does not breed, it just reproduces itself. So it's not, so is it stop being a species for that reason? They're still described as species. If you look them up, they still have species names. But what does it mean? It doesn't mean much. It just say it's this clam and not call it a species. Or you can think if it makes someone feel more scientific, they can call it a species, but it doesn't have a lot of meaning in the case of an asexual clam. I mean, what is it really? I can't imagine why you would want to call something that can't even have sex or engage in sex a species, except to have a fancier word for form or type. It's a type of organism, a particular clam that does that is a type of organism. But is it a species? Who knows? I would say it's not very useful. And then there are also some various cases where you have hybrids being produced on an ongoing basis, like I mentioned earlier, like Brewster's warbler, where they're getting described as species, but
I kind
it's
of
not,
love it.
they're not even able to produce offspring themselves in a lot of cases, but they still get described as species because they're still appearing
They're
all the time.
recognizable and nameable. I kind of love it that in biology, biologists struggle to define what a species is, but they also sometimes struggle to say what's alive and what's not alive. So like viruses are kind of in the gray zone there. And the physicist can't tell you what time or space or electrons are, but at least the chemists, they're reliable. They don't try and overplay their hand.
So, of course, you might be biased in that
Yes,
regard.
with a chemistry background, I have to defend my people. Now, we could talk for hours, and I am so glad that I got an opportunity to catch up with you.
Well, it's been great you there, so.
We've discussed coming back to have another episode or two in the future, because and I'll just tease it a little bit here, but your most attention-grabbing theory that I just absolutely love concerns the origins of humans. And I want to devote a whole episode to delve into this because I've seen you just touch on it kind of superficially in other podcasts. And this is such an important topic. I think it deserves a really detailed deep dive at some time in the future. And then I'd love to come back after that and just talk about maybe a bit more about like the implications and the applications of hybridization. Though I guess we've touched on that a bit today. So we'll see how we go with that.
Okay, well, that's fine. And my day is just beginning here, but yours is drawing to an end. And so perhaps, I don't know how tired you are, but we could stop at this point if you want.
Yes, we'll wrap it up today and we'll organize another time. So I just want to say again,
Well, it's been a pleasure.
thank you very much for all of the work that you've done, for the time and energy you've put into putting it out into the world. That doesn't just happen, and for giving me time today to talk to you and to introduce your ideas to the audience. It's just I can't say thank you enough.
It's been a pleasure talking with you, Shane. And I look forward to our future conversations. And
Excellent.
now I'll let you go to bed on the other time on the other side of the world.
Yes. Excellent. Thank you very much.
All right. You're welcome. Bye.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.